You need no introduction. In some way, you need no introduction in this group, but I'm going to do a bit of a one for those who are new to you. Tim is an award-winning scholar, educator, and activist who taught at Harvard University for more than two decades. And he's the Stanley Patterson Professor of American History and academic co-director at the Boston Clemente Course, a free college humanities course for lower-income adults in Dorchester. So he was the co-recipient of the 2015 National Humanities Medal from President Obama. He has taught in Clemente since its founding in 2001. Tim is the author of five books, a media commentator, a supporter of the use of arts through American Repertory Theater in promoting social justice. Tim has devoted his life to public service and social justice, and was part of the first ever LGBTQ delegation from the United States to Palestine and Israel. And he currently serves as board chair for Free the Slaves, a leading global NGO in the fight against modern slavery. Tim and his partner live in Provincetown with their chocolate lab puppy Rogers, named in honor of the late great Fred Rogers. So we welcome you, Tim, to the topic that you created or gave voice to anyway, and we can't wait to hear from you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Lindsay. I so appreciate that. Just one small point about something you said in the bio, which is I'm sort of adjacent to the National Humanities Medal. The Clemente Course in the Humanities won the National Humanities Medal. So therefore, we're all associated with it, but I don't.
Okay.
It was the course that won it, not me.
Well, it was a vision in your eye, I know.
Yeah, well, you know, we all get a little piece of the shine, I think. Anyway, speaking of that, it's great to see my friend Anne Murphy, my dear friend and colleague, who was, I am her successor, was the co-director of the Boston Clemente course, and we taught together in Dorchester and then online in virtual space for many, many, many years. Anne and I go way back. And so when you popped up, Anne, my whole spirit lifted, not that it wasn't already lifted by all of you, which is a group I've come to really, really love. And so it's such an honor to be back here and see so many familiar faces. And Linda, thanks for inviting me and coordinating this. And Muna, thank you also for your words and your work and all that you bring to this space and to this organization and community, but also the work you do in your professional life with in public policy and with students and with particularly raising this next generation of powerful women leaders, which I hope I am also very much part of in my own work here at Harvard. And thanks so much for everything. I mean, what a wonderful thing, a 50th anniversary. My God, half a century. I'm a historian, so I think in these terms. I think in generations and centuries and half a century. And half a century is a very big deal. I don't need to tell you all that, but that's a long time. I'm now over half a century old, so I understand newly the importance of these markers. But the 50th anniversary is just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. I also want to just name the elephant in the room that, like, you have a 10-person lecture series, a 10-part lecture series, and you've graciously invited me into this space as a man to be talking about radically inclusive female-centered spaces to mark a remarkable women-centered, radically inclusive organization. And I understand the irony of that fully. The danger and treachery of mansplaining, which I'm going to really try to avoid today. But I just wanted to say very humbly that I really appreciate the invitation always, but especially today and in this moment as we mark this extraordinary anniversary. I'm glad, Linda, that you mentioned the note I wrote in remembrance of Liz, which I actually wanted to open with. So I was a little worried that you were going to read the whole thing. So I, but I wanted to just, for those of you who haven't re read it, in the Pink Book, which I love. I read all of it through and through. But I just wanted to start with these words because they honor Liz, and Liz was the person who brought me into this space and invited me in over and over. I will always remember how friendly and gracious Liz Dodson Gray was when she first welcomed me into the Community of Theological Opportunities program, now Women Explore, almost a decade and a half ago. I was the replacement for my late mentor, Howard Zinn, who was sick, and I was not sure what to expect. But Liz welcomed me energetically, as if I were Howard Zinn. Of course, I was not and am not. But it meant such a great deal to me back in those early days of trying to figure out my way in this world. As soon as I entered the gallery space of the University Lutheran Church, it was so very clear to me that Liz was the respected leader of this remarkable and unique group. Over the years, I've had the honor of being an annual speaker. And during this time, I have come to understand Liz's profound vision and impact more deeply. She is one of those rare people who combines the head, the heart, and the soul in equal measure, a fierce intellectual, unrivaled community organizer, and steady moral force in a world that desperately needs all of these things. When Liz fell ill a few years ago, I could feel both her physical absence and her spiritual presence. That the work of Women Explore continues is one part of her robust legacy, and I am grateful to be one among its many inheritors. I would be remiss if I didn't mention what a blessing it has been for me as a younger gay man trying to live a morally consistent life to be welcomed lovingly and unconditionally into this community of female elders. You all have done that over and over again. And in doing so, have become a powerful model for me of what radically inclusive women-centered spaces can be. I am forever grateful to Liz Dodson Gray for extending that initial invitation to join your ranks, and my love to all of you, Liz's given and chosen family, during this time of genuine mourning and joyful remembrance. So I wanted to start with that because I really did love Liz, and I felt the love that she had for all of you and for the little bit she had left over for me. And it was very moving. And so it's great to be back here. So I wanted to start with that, with her. It's also fitting, as a number of you have mentioned, to be convening here to mark the 50th anniversary of your organization the day after International Women's Day, March 8th. And this is within, although I take your point, Muna, but a day, it's within Women's History Month, of course, which is also Disability Awareness Month. And I can't help but note and mark the passing just a few days ago on March 4th of the feminist, civil rights titan, Judy Heumann, who was also one of the leading lights and figures in disability rights activism, as well as feminism and civil rights more broadly, who passed away on March 4th. And so this is someone I think is particularly to Muna's point about the intersectionality urgency of thinking about interlocking systems of oppression and also of identity and social formation and experience, sort of honoring Liz, but also honoring people like Judy Heumann, is, I think, appropriate in this month and this day that itself represents an intersection of sorts for all of us. And I also, just a personal note, speaking of our students, Judy Heumann was the special advisor on international disability rights at the U.S. State Department and was appointed by Barack Obama, and then I think vacated under Trump, of course. That's a whole other story. But the next person to hold that role, and the person who currently holds that role, is Sarah Minkara, who's actually one of my former students from the Kennedy School. And so, you know, the beat goes on. And I just want to name that, right? That sort of intergenerational through lines of all of this. International Women's Day, you probably know this, has really interesting origins. The origin story is both radical and contested, and at times sort of mythological. That the day itself was first sort of conceived by radical socialists and labor feminists and so forth in the late part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. But in Europe, actually, it gets its origins. It was named first and invoked first as a kind of, as a, it has a European origin. And 1907 is the date that is often marked, and by the historians who've done the most work on this, as the sort of first of these days. So nearly a century ago. And interestingly, that date, 1907, was meant to mark the 50th anniversary of a workers' strike, a textile and garment workers' strike in New York. And so there was this kind of transatlantic U.S.-European labor, feminist, radical, socialist kind of intersection that was in some ways the incubator for the origin story. The problem and the rub is that textile and garment workers' strike in 1857 may not have actually happened. So there was an invention of an origin story that we can't actually document actually happened. There were, of course, textile and garment workers strikes and feminist labor radicals and socialists who worked together throughout the 19th century and well into the 20th and 21st. And yet that particular strike, an origin story, which becomes the sort of the inspiration of International Women's Day in 1907, is itself a kind of founding mythology, like so many founding mythologies, including the very one that is often bandied about as the origin story of the United States. So I just thought it was very interesting that this great day, which should not just be a day, it should be all year, every year, in perpetuity, itself has really interesting contested and mythological origins, but very clearly also radical origins. And the reason why I wanted to mention that is because, as you all know, those of you who have heard me speak before, one of the things that I've spent my life and career working on is the history of radicalisms and the history of social justice movements and intersecting and interlocking social justice movements in the United States and also globally more recently. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit today about some of those kind of radical sisterhoods that I've been thinking about a lot lately in the work that I do in the world. And there are three kind of recent inspirations for thinking about this a little bit more deeply, in addition to obviously the great invitation to come here and reflect on some of these things with all of you. One is a course that I'm teaching currently at the Kennedy School and at the Graduate School of Education at Harvard, which actually has many different types of graduate students, not just Kennedy School and Ed School students, but a whole range of graduate students and a couple of undergrads, including actually a mother and child pair. For the first time, I have a mother and a child in my class. The mother is a mid-career student at the Kennedy School, and the child is a sophomore in the college, and it's totally fabulous. And the mom is taking the class because the child has just come out as trans and non-binary. And is trying to sort of think about the deep histories that help the mother, her, understand the child, them, Elio, which is totally fabulous. And I love that. But that course has been one of the things we've been focusing on in the course are these radical sisterhoods that emerged among lesbians, white lesbians, lesbians of color, interracial and interclass, lesbian feminist solidarity circles and so forth. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, but I've been thinking a lot about the ways in which the history of LGBTQ peoples in the United States is itself also a history of radical sisterhoods. And I'll get more into that there. And it's really pushed me, including a lot of my students. When I first started teaching this class, there were a lot of gay men who took this course. And now it's more women, queer women, straight and cis-identified women, and non-binary and trans folks, some of whom identify as women or trans feminine. And so I'm being pushed in my teaching, right, to think much more expansively, I think, than I have before about these radical sisterhoods. So get more into that. Another thing that happened just very recently, last Friday, is the Ed School has this amazing Alumni of Color Conference, and it's a conference every year that is run by and led by students, former students at the Ed School, all of whom are students of color, Latinx and African American, AAPI, Indigenous, et cetera. And it's a really wonderful gathering that has all sorts of things in it. It has panel discussions and round tables and healing circles and meditation spaces and all sorts of other film screenings, obviously social time, drinking and eating and breaking bread and all those things. But one of the things that they did this year is they launched the conference with a round table on sisterhood with five of my colleagues, all women of color, at the Ed School. And it was just the most remarkable way to begin. And so this conference, which draws mostly alums and students, current students, was kind of launched and kicked off by these five remarkable women, you know, many of whom, most of whom I consider also dear friends and colleagues. And the way that they were talking about, you know, the need for sisterhood in a place like Harvard and in a place like its profession, like the academy. And all of them spoke to the ways in which they find each other. The first thing they do when they get to spaces like this is find each other, right? And they all have each other's phones and they text and they drink and they exercise. And they were talking about all doing a Peloton circle during COVID, the way that they share pedagogies and politics and all of these things. And I was just so incredibly moved by what they were representing in that moment of solidarity, but how they were then moving all of us in the audience, particularly the students of color and women of color, who were really struggling in their own ways to find each other and to build those sisterhoods. And they talked about the deep sisterhoods that they've had since they were children with people that they grew up with. And it was just a remarkable moment where these brilliant intellectuals and academics kind of pulled the curtain open and shared their personal and political lives, right? And mapped it onto their pedagogical and intellectual lives. And it was just really moving. And it made me, I've been thinking ever since about the power of that. And then the third thing that's kind of inspired this lately is the Clemente course in the humanities, which is a college humanities course for lower income adults. And it's run through the Codman Square Health Center in Dorchester. And it's funded by Mass Humanities, our state humanities council. And the students take five different disciplines in the course of a year, moral philosophy, American history, literature, art history, and writing and critical thinking. And at the end of it, if they succeed in finishing the year and get all their work done, they get 6 college credits from Bard College in New York that they can then transfer to complete degrees or to start degrees in higher education. And a lot of our students are folks who have either not gone to college for a variety of reasons or people have gone and dropped out. And so this can be a bridge to or a bridge back to higher education. That's not the only thing that students get out of this. But one of the things, as Anne knows, and Anne's been amazing in fostering and cultivating this and extending and expanding it over the years, most of our students are women and most of them are women of color. And they find in the Clemente course, right, Anne, a sisterhood, right? They find a community of women intellectuals and scholars and citizens that from a whole variety of backgrounds that shows up every single day in the class, right? That is their voices are powerful, they're centered, they're interesting, they challenge us and they teach us. And one of the things that Anne has done, I just want to give Anne a shout out, is that she has helped to cultivate over the years a women's writing group that was an extension of the Clemente course. And I don't know how many years ago that was, Anne. It was almost a decade, I think, or more. And women from the course who are either in the course or have been in the course, and then their friends, they've brought other kind of sisters into this writing group. And Anne is a facilitator of this and a participant. And it's been a remarkable thing. And it's led to published work and memoirs and progress and all sorts of other things that have been really rich and amazing that aren't particularly linked exactly to the course, but are an outgrowth of it. And so I'm thinking about these different spaces, my own course, and then the Alumni Color Conference, and then the Clemente course more broadly, as these places that like require me, certainly, and I think inspire a lot of people to think about radical sisterhood. And so when I think about these sort of examples throughout history, you know, I mean, obviously one place to start or go to is the Seneca Falls Convention in July of 1848, which was at that moment the first ever public political gathering of women for the express purpose of articulating a rights agenda, an agenda of women's rights, what they called woman's rights, because in the 19th century, as you probably all know, it was a singular woman and then became women's over time. Actually, the first International Women's Day was International Woman's Day. The same language sort of creeped into the 20th century and then was expanded out into a plural. But the Seneca Falls Convention was this gathering of the best estimates are between 200 and 300 folks, mostly women. There were 20 or 30 men who were also there, including Frederick Douglass, who famously gave a very powerful address on voting rights that would help to push that part of the platform. But this was a remarkable and historic gathering that in some ways coalesced the energy that women activists had already been manifesting as women's rights activists, as temperance activists, as evangelical activists, as abolitionists. Many of them were found their kind of political start and inspiration, the abolitionist women, both Black women and white women. And what they did, as you probably all know, they produced this Declaration of Sentiments and Resolutions, which was the big kind of manifesto that comes out of the convention. And I just want to read the beginning of this because it's totally fabulous and you'll recognize the language. It's a complete kind of riff and appropriation of the Declaration of Independence, written by Thomas Jefferson, who was no feminist or egalitarian in any way. But they wrote this. They said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, that to secure those rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed," et cetera, et cetera. They talk or they use, that's the exact language other than men and women of the Declaration. But then they're like, "Prudence indeed will dictate the governments long established should not be changed for lighter transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of women under the government, and this government, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to demand the equal station to which they are entitled. The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman, having in direct object the establishment of absolute tyranny over her. To prove this, let the facts be submitted to a candid world." And then it ends the beginning by saying, "Now, in view of this entire disenfranchisement of one half the people of this country, their social and religious degradation, in view of the unjust laws above mentioned, and because women do feel themselves aggrieved, oppressed, and fraudulently deprived of their most sacred rights, we insist that they have immediate admission to all the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of the United States." So they rewrite the Declaration of Independence, right, and put into play this incredibly radical document, which is demanding immediate, full, free, and equal citizenship, right? And you can imagine how well this went over with the patriarchy and the politicians who propped it up. It did not go over particularly well, but what it did is it lit a fire. In some ways, it was both a consolidation and a coalescence, a coming together of all of this kind of radical feminist and womanist energy that had already been in existence. And it gave it a kind of, it was like a catalytic converter, right? So sort of like inspired even more activism over time, which then becomes channeled into the abolitionist movement and out of it also into a new women's rights movement and a suffrage movement that extended well beyond the Civil War into the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It inspired all sorts of other than the women's club organization movement, which was in many ways a whites only women movement, not a radically inclusive movement. It was racially circumscribed initially, as were some of the suffrage organizations. And there were great debates within these organizations about racial equality and justice and whether Black women were included in the conception of women's rights and voting rights. And yet it also inspired interracial alliances between white and Black and other and indigenous and other women. And it also inspired an African-American women's club movement, which was inspired by people like Ida B. Wells Garnett, who was a leading force, the leading voice for against lynching and the rise and scourge of racial violence in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. These clubs became places where, as my colleague Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham argues, a place where Black women in particular were engaged in a kind of respectability politics, a term that I think a lot of our students right now misuse because they don't understand, they haven't read Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham's work. And Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham is talking about a politics of respectability among Black women who are doubly disenfranchised and sometimes triply disenfranchised, right, as a way to gain access to public and political matters that they might not have been given access to, and they have to engage in a kind of moral respectability in order to get in and do that work. And many of these club organizations were also tied to Black churches and to historically Black colleges and universities. And this too become, these two become locations of a radical sisterhood that is centered around Black women's experiences and demands, but also inclusive of white women who had not been, many of them, inclusive of them to begin with. And so this club organization, women's club movement, comes right through the kind of Seneca Falls energy and the rise of women's rights and suffrage and comes out of abolitionism. And so you can see the kind of radical ferment and these various incubators that are producing this really profound kind of emergence of sisterhoods in the 19th century. When you move into the 20th century, right, and I'm just giving, touching on a couple of these things, when you move into the 20th century, you have some, you know, other kinds of expressions that are linked very clearly to modern kinds of thinking and politics and practice and resistance and protest. And so one of the things that can I share my screen, Linza? Is that possible?
Who's the host?
I actually can. I think I can. I can,
you can do it.
Do it
without. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just gonna hold on 1 second. Gonna show up where is this here? Hold on. Whoops. Sorry. So I wanted to show a if I can do this. Yes. Here it is. This is a document that will be familiar for those of you who know your civil rights history. This is a document that was a flyer that was dated Monday, December 5th, 1955. And it starts with, another Negro woman has been arrested and thrown into jail because she refused to get up out of her seat on the bus for a white person to sit down. It is the second time since the Claudette Colbert case that a Negro woman has been arrested for the same thing. This has to be stopped. And then it talks about rights and it talks about women. This woman's case is going to come up and we can't afford to stay out of school and da, da, da. And it calls on women and mothers and daughters in particular to engage in what becomes, as you can probably guess, the Montgomery bus boycott. And this was a flyer that was produced, it was typed and written and then mimeographed and then distributed by the Women's Political Council, which was an organization that had been, that had had its origins in Montgomery, Alabama, in the 1940s. And so this was a group that formed after World War II, and it was specifically a Black women's organization rooted in churches that was also connected to the NAACP there, where Rosa Parks, the woman in question, was the treasurer of that organization and had been trained in nonviolent civil disobedience, which was one of the things that led her to engage in the protest the day that really ignited this movement. And so the reference there to the Negro woman is to Rosa Parks, but this was a flyer that was produced and circulated and organized by women. And one of the things that a lot of people don't know, even people who know American history and civil rights history, don't realize that the Montgomery bus boycott has its origins in women's organizing and activism in Montgomery. that Martin Luther King had just gotten to the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church as the preacher. He was still a graduate student at BU. He was ABD working on his dissertation, and he and Coretta Scott King moved with their two young children to Montgomery, Alabama, and he showed up, and it was the church that he was now leading that was a hub for the Women's Political Council and Rosa Parks and Joanne Robinson and these other folks who were already doing this organizing. And so the man, Martin Luther King, did not make the movement. The movement made the man, and the movement was inspired by this radical sisterhood of these respectable Black women who were doing this political work that led to the Montgomery bus boycott, which is probably the most successful economic boycott for civil rights in the history of the United States and the world. Is incredibly successful. 97% of Black people refused to ride the bus for 13 months, brought the bus company to its knees, led to a Supreme Court case that ultimately outlawed segregation in busing throughout the United States. So that kind of sisterhood of the black Women's Political Council in Montgomery, right, is another one of these sisterhoods that I think about in my own mind when I think about the power and the importance of these radical and inclusive sisterhoods throughout history. Another example I just wanted to give to all of you again, I'm going to show you a trailer for a documentary film that I highly recommend. But if you haven't seen it, I'm going to show it to you now. It's a 2-minute trailer, and I'll say a couple words on the other side of this. But here's the trailer.
In the mid-1950s, conformity was at its height. More than 10 million paint-by-number kits were sold each year. Society lived by the numbers and stayed within the lines. Homosexual culture existed only in codes and subtext, hidden between the lines.
Once I had a secret love,
a secret, secret love,
that lived within the heart of me,
within the heart of me.
And she arrived, and she had on, open-toed pumps and a little green gabardine suit. And she was carrying a briefcase. And never before had I seen a woman carrying a briefcase. I had a party at my apartment for her and invited all the folks from work. And she spent most of her time in the kitchen with the guys who were trying to teach her how to tie a tie and smoking cigars. She said I was her good straight friend, but she always accused me of flirting with her too. And
flirted with everybody.
In the bars, you were just interested in getting drunk and in finding a partner. I think the contribution that Dallin Film made was tremendous in the founding DOB and helping people get out of the bars and organize and try to do something worthwhile as a group.
We've seen change that we never thought would happen in our lifetime. The fact that we're sitting here talking like this is a miracle to us.
There's no secret anymore.
Never in the world could we have dreamed of the Pink Games, or whether we'd be electing our own people, or
we'd be marching on Washington.
Marching on Washington, or any of that. You have to be involved in politics, and that is where change has come about that I have seen in the last 50 years.
So that is a trailer for a movie, a documentary film called No Secret Anymore. And this centers the story of Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, who were among the co-founders of a group called the Daughters of Bilitis. which was a group that formed in 1955 in San Francisco, that was for lesbian women to be able to gather privately in private spaces, their homes and parlors and other spaces that where they wouldn't be under surveillance and suspicion for their activities and their sort of tendencies. And the Daughters of Bilitis get their name from a book by a man, a male literary scholar and poet, who's the Secret Poems of Bilitis. And Bilitis in this book, as published in the early part of the 20th century, is positioned and framed as a contemporary of Sappho's from the island of Lesbos. And it turns out, though Sappho was real and wrote poetry and lived on Lesbos and is an inspiration for a lot of modern lesbian and feminist works, Bilitis did not exist, another founding myth, another mythological myth. So they went to Bilitis, which was an invention of a man, a male poet, in order to name their organization, the Daughters of Bilitis, because they didn't want lesbian, of course, or gay or homosexual in the title. And so they called themselves the Daughters of Bilitis. And it sounds like the, you know, Daughters of the Confederacy or Daughters of the American Revolution or whatever. And then they would meet, and there were chapters that spread throughout the country once people found out about this. And so there were these private gatherings and sisterhood convenings of lesbian women all over the country that helped to form the backbone of what was called the homophile movement in the 1950s and 1960s, long before Stonewall and the rise of gay and lesbian liberation a decade and a half later. And so the Daughters of Bilitis is another one of these sort of radical sisterhoods that helps to launch, right, all of this new kind of change in the world that was happening at that time. And they too are kind of origin and catalyst, a catalytic converter of a different sort for modern lesbian and queer women. And then the last example I wanted to give was also an example from this movement, but also that combines a number of traditions that we've been talking about. And that's the Combahee River Collective. Actually, I wanted to put an article in the chat, because one of the things that is important about the Daughters of Bilitis is that Adele Martin and Phyllis Lyon, who ended up getting married, they had a 50-plus-year relationship. They were married by Gavin Newsom in 2008 in defiance of Proposition 8 in California around the same time that Obama was running for president. And so Gavin Newsom, very famously, and Kamala Harris was standing there too because she was the attorney general at the time. So they were married after 50 years of being lesbian lovers, partners, and wives by Gavin Newsom in defiance of Prop 8 before marriage equality is legalized nationally. But they never claimed that they were the founders or co-founders of the Daughters of Bilitis. They claimed that they were in the founding generation or founding group. And there's a really interesting article by Melinda Lowe, who's a scholar and writer, about the women of color origins of the Daughters of Bilitis and the group and the women of color who were actually there in the first meetings in the homes of these lesbians in San Francisco. And so it's another piece of this history. So the last thing I wanted to mention was a group called the Combahee River Collective, which was actually formed in Boston by Barbara Smith and Beverly Smith and Demita Frazier. I don't know if any of you know any of them. I know Demita still lives here. She lives in Roxbury. She's a friend of mine. And they formed what was called the Combahee River Collective. The Combahee River was a geographical location where Harriet Tubman did much of her work of freeing fugitive slaves during the antebellum period and the Civil War period. And so the Combahee invokes this longer history of Black feminist work and abolitionist work and civil rights work. And they produced it was a collective. So it was a group at first of Black lesbian feminist women. Many of them had grown up in poverty or in working class conditions, and they wrote a statement called the Combahee River Collective Statement in 1977. And it begins with these words. And the reason why I want to read this is because so much of this is so incredibly present and modern right now. Not that 1977 is that long ago, but actually Women Explore predates 1977. But here's the opening language. We are a collective of Black feminists who have been meeting together since 1974. During that time, we have been involved in the process of defining and clarifying our politics, while at the same time doing political work within our own group and in coalition with other progressive organizations and movements. The most general statement of our politics at the present time would be that we are actively committed to struggling against racial, sexual, heterosexual, and class oppression, and see as our particular task the development of an integrated analysis and practice based upon the fact that the major systems of oppression are interlocking. The synthesis of these oppressions creates the conditions of our lives. As Black women, we see Black feminism as the logical political movement to combat the manifold and simultaneous oppressions that all women face. And two things that stand out there, lots of things, it represents, it's seen as a kind of founding manifesto or its own kind of declaration of independence of Black feminism, a Black feminist intellectual and political tradition. So it's seen as that. But it also coins the term identity politics for the first time. The first time you hear the phrase identity politics is in this Combahee River Collective statement, and understanding that identity, our lived experiences, our social positions, are deeply influential in terms of our worldview, in terms of how we see the world, how we walk through it, et cetera. And that those create differences, right? That Black women are different from white women, and gay men are different from lesbians, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so this was, you know, it may seem obvious to us now, even though we don't always practice or keep this in mind, or many people, but it framed it as identity is really important to politics. And this is something, of course, that we know is it fueling the culture wars on all sides, even to this day. The other thing about this is what they're talking about in terms of interlocking systems of oppression around race and gender and sexuality and class. They're articulating what later on Kimberly Crenshaw in 1989 to 1993 in a series of law school articles coins as intersectionality, which is not a new idea. Kimberly Crenshaw, who's a critical race theorist at Columbia and a dear friend of mine, is someone I studied with in graduate school, because I actually did take courses in critical race theory. She coins the term intersectionality, but the Combahee River Collective statement is actually defining it and putting it into practice. And if you go back to Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth and Harriet Jacobs and so many of the Black women abolitionists of the 19th century, you see articulations of intersectionality there too. So there's a very long genealogy, right, of particularly of women of color and particularly Black women, right, who have been talking about interlocking systems of oppression and identity politics and the intersections of race, gender, sexuality, and class for centuries. And so these sisterhoods too are really important, and radically so, in that they give us not just like new forms of protest and political organizing, but new ideas, new political terms, new political language, new political identities, right? That help to kind of keep the momentum going of these the long and deep history of these radical sisterhoods over time. And the thing that I wanted to raise here is sort of, what do I mean when I say radically inclusive women-centered space? I could have just said the radical power of women-centered spaces. And so what I want to turn to in the last piece here is to just ask a question about what we mean when we say inclusive. Like, what does it mean to be an inclusive space, an inclusive women-centered space, an inclusive queer space, an inclusive radical or progressive space? Because all of these groups that I have talked about, all of these sisterhoods have limitations. They have limits. They have contradictions and tensions within them, right? Some were white-only spaces, and some were Black-centered spaces, and some were more queer or lesbian spaces, and others were, you know, so what do we mean when we say inclusion? And how do we square that and sort of think about that in relationship to safe spaces and to separate spaces and to affinity spaces? Like, what does it mean? Like, if I were to leave right now, right, this would, I think, be and often has been an all-female, all-women group, right? And what happens when, like, someone like me shows up, right, or leaves? And what happens when to women of color spaces or Black women when white women show up? Or what happens to white women when a Black woman comes to the meeting? Right. And how do we think about the inclusion when we want to honor both inclusion and intersection and kind of expansive ideas about identity and community and justice, at the same time that we also want to honor the fact that sometimes we just want to be with our people. And that that may be a more narrow or less inclusive, maybe even exclusive idea about community, identity, and justice. So I raise that because I think that these histories and these sisterhoods allow us to think about that in a really sophisticated way and in a really powerful way, and that these radical sisterhoods and the history of them can be a muse for us at a moment where identity politics is ferocious, where the culture wars have been reignited around the politics of identity, where inequities and injustices are so differentiated and so ever pervasive, and that in a world where these systems of oppression seem to be always run by the same types of people, and they're common for all of us, maybe in different ways, for different reasons, but we're all under siege. And so I wanted to end on a more personal note, because I, one of the things I've learned from women and from feminists and from women of color and lesbian and queer women, is that the personal is the political and vice versa. Like, that's really important to me. And it's something that I think a lot of men have trouble with, right? That men are very famous for their binaries and their compartmentalization and, of course, their hierarchies. And so, you know, what does a radically inclusive women-centered space mean for someone like me who does identify as a man? And when I think about that, that's a troubling thing to wrestle with. And I want to be honest about that, because as a man, especially a white cis man of a certain socioeconomic status now, although not nearly by origin or evolution, but now I live in Provincetown, but I could never afford to live in Provincetown until very recently. And, you know, when I think about that, my own kind of positionality and intersections and both oppression and privilege, and what I've learned from these radical sisterhoods, what I have absorbed, what I've listened to, what I've witnessed, what I've been invited into, and also told to keep my space and my distance. But what have I learned from these women, you, all, these organizations and these histories? I've learned a lot. And I think in some ways, it's all of you and all of this that has both made me certainly a feminist for sure, but it's also made me a radical, and it's also made me an egalitarian, and it's also made me understand how precarious and precious the struggle for rights and justice and freedom and equality for all of us is, and how important it is that I be part of that work as a partner and a co-conspirator in deep solidarity with all of you, just as I want you to be in deep solidarity with me and other folks who are doing other work in the world, but very much aligned and integrated work in the world. And so when I think about how I try to be radically inclusive, which is something I am committed to, I think about the women and the women-centered spaces that I've had the honor of being part of that have made me into the man that I am becoming. I just wanted to honor that. Yeah. And let me end paying tribute to three women. My two grandmothers, Anne's going to laugh because she's heard this story. Some of you have been introduced to my grandmothers before, Yolanda Barbernitz and Cecilia McCarthy, my mom's mom and my dad's mom, who were both immigrant women, who were two very different kinds of women. One from Italy, one from Ireland. And my Irish side, my grandmother, Cecilia McCarthy, Grandma McCarthy, was very, very intellectually talented and ambitious. And my great grandfather told her that school was unnecessary for girls. So when she was a senior in high school, she applied to college secretly, was admitted to Plattsburgh State, which was a school that took women at the time, and went there, ran away from home and went there, unbeknownst to my great grandfather. And she kept in touch by writing letters to her 15 siblings and her mom, all of whom knew that she was there, but her father didn't. She graduated, got a degree in education. Along the way, started the women's athletic program at Plattsburgh State, was the captain of the first girls' women's basketball team. She was a great basketball player. She taught me how to shoot a two-hand set shot when I was a little kid because she babysat me. And then she moved to New York City, and she became a public school teacher, and she became a department chair, and she became a union president. In fact, she may be the first woman union president and department chair in her district, and maybe the first woman union president for teachers in the state of New York. And when she retired, when I was born, 1971, and she moved upstate to become my principal guardian, she raised me as a child because my parents were both public school teachers and working all the time. And she moved, but when she retired, they named the street to the new high school after her, and it's called McCarthy Way. And I have the street sign in my office. Some people think it's a vanity plate, but it's actually my grandmother's honor. And my other grandmother, Grandma Bobrinets, my grandfather was a Ukrainian, so that's where the Bobrinets comes from. But she was Debonis and Valentini. And she dropped out of high school, actually dropped out of middle school, and became a cuffer on the end of an assembly line in a garment factory. So she put the cuffs on shirts like the one I'm wearing. And she was not part of a union because they would not allow women to organize. And she and her sisters, there were four of them, we call them the Golden Girls from Sicily, they staged a walkout one day and hid in my grandmother's attic. And so my grandmother was also a kind of labor radical of the type that might have been there if that garment and textile workers strike had happened in 1957 that inspired International Women's Day. And she was someone who, she was feisty, ferocious, an amazing cook, made all of her own pasta and sauce, which I still delight in whenever my mother does it. And now I'm trying to learn how to do it too, all with the same macaroni maker. She decided when I was in late middle school, around the same time that I was the same age that she had dropped out of school, and she decided she wanted to get her GED. And part of it was linked to the fact I was both of their only, I was their only grandchild on both sides. And she, I was an honor student. I was starting to develop a talent for school and show a real potential as a student. And she was embarrassed that she did not have a high school degree or a college degree. So one of the inspirations for getting her GED was she wanted me to be, and she told me this, I didn't want you to be embarrassed of me, which never happened. It could never have happened. But when I think about that, she studied for her GED. While I was in high school, she was in high school, much older. She would help me with my math because I wasn't a very good math teacher, and I would help her with her spelling and her writing because she wasn't a very good speller. To the day she died, the last card she sent me, she apologized for her spelling. She beat me to the high school degree. She got her GED before I got my high school diploma. And when she passed away, she was the last of my grandparents to pass away, I buried my PhD with her, my diploma, my Columbia PhD in her casket. It's buried with her. And my mother asked me what I wanted, and I said, I want her GED. And so if you come into my office at the Graduate School of Education at Harvard, where their grandson now teaches, you will see the McCarthy Way sign, and you will see the GED. And they're right next to each other, next to each other, not in a hierarchy. They're right next to each other. And I tell this story to all my students who are sick of hearing about my tale of two grandmothers. But the reason I love education and why I will always be a teacher is because both of them loved education. One who got it, lucky, ran away, got her degree, became a teacher, a brilliant educator, someone I still aspire to be like. And the other one loved education at least as much because she was denied it and then got it herself later on. And both of them showed me what that meant. And so when I think about the radical power of women and women-centered spaces, right, that were inclusive, they both loved me and they wanted me to become a certain kind of person and a certain kind of man. And when I think about what I'm trying to become, I think of them. And I'll end with this. My niece, Malia, who is 13, is an African-American girl. She's the daughter of the kid that I mentored in the Big Brother program at Harvard that I went and became, that I ended up adopting and raising as my own kid. And she's his kid, and she's 13, and she calls me Grunkle because I'm grandpa and uncle. because I was sort of brother and father to Malcolm. And she's 13. She's in eighth grade. She just won the city championship in girls basketball. She's the only eighth grader in the entire city league, and she started most of her games. She was honored yesterday at International Women's Day at City Hall, her whole team, by Mayor Wu. And she texted us from, she's like, I'm with the mayor. Like, of course you are. And so she was with the mayor, and she just got in, and she just won her championship. They made it to the third round of the state tournament. She cried like a baby when she lost, but she had the greatest season. And now she's set up to have a wonderful basketball career. She's going to run track with all the girls on her team, because this group of older Black women, mostly Black girls, took her under their wing and mentored her. And now they're inviting her to run track with them and play pickup, and they study together and they have fun together and they're doing all these things. And that too is a sisterhood that she loves. And her name is Malia. She was born the year the Obamas went into the White House. She's named for Malia Obama. So she has her own inheritance in that way. And tomorrow she finds out where she goes to high school. And her future is wide open. And when I think about all of the histories that bear down on us, the intersectional histories, the interracial histories, the feminist histories, these radical histories, right? And I think about what they continue to do and how they continue to manifest. I'm so grateful that I can still be along for this remarkable journey. And so thank you all for inviting me to be part of yours, and congratulations again on everything you've accomplished and everything you will continue to do.
Well, thank you, Tim. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you. I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm just so deeply moved. I have goosebumps to hear a man such as you really see us so clearly and celebrate what we're doing and why we're doing it, and to know us in that way. That feels to me very unusual and very precious. So thank you. So it is our time for discussion. We have Muna with us, and that's great. And we started something before we start our discussion. I just want to say we're starting something new this year. Is on our blog site, which is part of our website. Apparently, it's a little red square that you can click on in our website, and it's our blog. And we have a resource list there, which are articles and films and poems or whatever people are putting in there that enhance the experience of what we're having this series. And so we certainly put up all the resources that you've offered us, Tim. Paula, will you put those on the blog? So that your story will keep on coming for people who are not here today, or those of us who want to revisit or delve more deeply into the different resources. So thank you for that as well, including the film A Secret No More, or No Secret Anymore.
Lindsay, I just wanted to say, I put a link to a love letter I wrote to Malia. I published it in 2015, and I'm giving it to her for her eighth grade graduation. It's been out there. People have read it, but it's my love letter to her. And I'm going to write a new one this spring and give it to her when she graduates from high school.
Well, yeah, because she gets to be seen so clearly by you as a young woman she's becoming, just as you are seeing us so clearly. That your heart and mind and soul are that big, Tim, just means so much. I don't even know how to have words for it. So thank you, and lucky Malia. and lucky Malcolm too, but that's another story. So this is our time for group discussion, which means Muna, if you would join us again, if you're available. I know you're weaving us into your workday, but if you're available, come forward. And Tim is going to stay until 1:30 to be with us. And we have time to ask questions, to share what happened for us as we were listening to you, Tim, and listening to you, Muna. You represent an opportunity for young women that many of us didn't have. So, please, we open the format to everybody until about 1:25. Then we'll do some announcements and say goodbye until next week. So who has questions, comments, curiosities, introspective responses? Did someone just raise their hand that I didn't see? Oh, Kathy, did you have something? Unmute. There you go.
Oh, thank you, Tim and Muna and all of you for just a wonderful presentation. Tim and Muna, too, I'm wondering if you have taken note of something that feels very personal to me, and that is as a white straight woman, having shown up for everybody's issues through most of the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, and then refighting some of those battles again, I have the feeling of some invisibility now as a white straight woman, that there is this organization of radical inclusion in infinity groups that know who they are. Black people are Black people, and gay les are gay les, and so on and so forth. That doesn't mean that we can't take the leadership from those folks and be part of those folks, because we can. But I do notice, to figure out allyship, that was pretty clear on what we could do in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s ones, aughts, and on and on. I find it harder now to be in the allyship category, as various and sundry affinity groups are organizing themselves and finding their own leadership and so on and so forth. So, not to go on indefinitely, because my question is never ending, because it's really a question for me. Is that something that you could speak to, or your thoughts on that?
To both Muna and Tim? Yeah.
Muna, you can go ahead first if you want.
Okay, sorry. It's not so easy on your phone sometimes to talk. And so, Kathy, your question is about whether you can still be an ally, even though there are groups are more homogeneous in terms of identity markers.
I think that's part of it. Yeah, I think that's certainly part of my question. Mm-hmm. Part of it is that I think the expectation is there's still a lot we can do as individuals, but finding that affinity groups over and above the folks that we and whatever. I mean, there are groups of affinity groups around, but the larger issue of white women coming together as helpmates and allies, which I think has been our role forever and ever. Mm-hmm. That's what seems to be a little harder to come by. So that's my question, is if you're observing that as well.
Well, there are definitely a lot more defined spaces, say, for women of color. That's absolutely true. And we have people in our organization, in the Center for Women in Politics and Public Policy. Our director is very involved in the Massachusetts Women of Color Coalition, for example. But our center has a lot of, it doesn't have the same kind of opportunity, say, like a Women Explore at the moment, where we have, a space to discuss issues, but we do have public, we do have public gatherings where we have a lot of, great discussions and opportunities for speaking. So, I think there are still opportunities for those kind of exchanges and gatherings, but they maybe aren't as frequently found as in previous times. So I think that there are, but I think that's a really interesting question too. One issue that I work on is peace and justice in Palestine, Israel, and I know that there are organizations that are, they're really, really interesting groupings of organizations. There are, there's faith-based kind of groupings like Jewish Voice for Peace, American Muslims for Palestine, and then like churches for Middle East peace and so forth, and different Christian groups and faith, you know, other denominational faith-based groups. But there are also kind of, I think, more general organizations too that gather people from all different identities. And there's a lot of actually coalition work on that issue, across different, you know, the faith-based and the secular lines both. So, I mean, just as one example. So, but it is a really interesting observation. So, about how we're organizing ourselves and whether that's always a good thing too. You know, whether we, as Tim said, they're coming for all of us. So maybe we really need to be, build much more solidarity and maybe kind of more large inclusive spaces that where we can really discuss and strategize, because they really, I agree with you, Tim, that they are coming for all of us and things are, don't feel really great at all right now in our country or the world. So.
Yeah, I think things are dire right now, and I'm usually someone who can muster up a certain amount of optimism and hope, not naive or gauzy optimism or hope, but I'm actually deeply, deeply, deeply concerned about what's going on. I mean, I didn't even mention it. I think it's like goes without saying, like what you know, the Dobbs decision, the incredible kind of public health and healthcare crisis, that, you know, voting rights, I mean, everything, I mean, reproductive justice, I mean, educational access, I mean, you know, I mean, it's never ending and debilitating and can be, I think, sometimes, you know, paralyzing in some ways. Your question is really important, and it's, I think it has so many levels and layers to it. You know, I think, I mean, one of the things that I hear there is, a kind of recognition that things have shifted or changed or are changing. And I think that's true. I think one of the things that's happening right now is that more people who have been minoritized and also or are minoritized, but have been like marginalized or excluded or denied power and access are coming into spaces where they are claiming that and having it for the first time. And I think that there is a world in which some of that comes with a sort of like, we don't need, right, the old allies anymore. We can do this on our own. I do think there is some of that. And I think there is a kind of, there is a proliferation of affinity groups that sometimes are not thinking about how our struggles for rights and equality and justice are intertwined and integrated. And I think some of that comes from the fact that, like, you know, I know, I'll say as a white person, right? You know, white people have often had very limited imaginations about what racial justice is, right? And to say nothing of limited practices insofar as that. I mean, there are some people, I've tried to be one of these people who have tried to show up and speak up and do whatever I can in solidarity with people of color and Black people in particular. But, you know, I haven't always done my thing. And I know, because I've been invited into spaces which are mostly Black people, how frustrated Black people are with white people, right? I mean, I've heard those, I've been lucky to listen in on those conversations. I participated in some of them. And there's a deep history of that neglect or that limitation that I think is fueling it too. And so there's some stuff that I think is very much like totally on point and justifiable. And because people have more room, social media, more power, more they're at the table more in positions of leadership or equality in organizations where they're voicing that more in ways that we may not have heard in quite this way before. And that's real. And yet at the same time, it doesn't solve the dilemma of like, what do you as a white cis, you know, a straight woman do, right? Because you care about justice and rights, your own and everybody else's. And I think, you know, for me, I have resigned myself to being fairly lonely. And I hate to say that because I really deeply crave and cultivate and cherish community. But, you know, I often feel very lonely politically, especially, right? Because like when all the groups are off meeting, right, I'm sort of like, where do I fit in? Right? Where do I go? Right? And so that sometimes can feel quite lonely. And so for me, the antidote to that is always to keep in mind that there's always going to be an opportunity, which is also a challenge, of building coalitions and being in solidarity and being the one to remind everybody, right, that we need to continue to keep our eyes on the interlocking nature of our work, while we're also doing it in different ways in different spaces with different peoples. And then the other piece too is that, like, what is the work we can do together, right? Can we plan a protest together? Right. That may only be a limited thing, but it's something we can devote ourselves to. Right. Can we organize a petition campaign to get a piece of legislation passed in this election cycle? We can do that work together. Right. And so I'm always looking for those opportunities where, because I think sometimes when you're doing the work, the sort of the purest politics of identity, which I think sometimes does get in the way to coalition building, becomes less important because we're trying to get that piece of legislation passed, or we're trying to make sure that no more of us die, or we're trying to, you know, figure out how on earth we can overturn Dobbs, right? And like that work can be done by lots of folks. And I think so finding the work so we can get not lost in the work, but that we can focus on the work, right? And keep the eyes on the prize. That to me is always what I'm in search of, right? And that means that there's got to be a cause and the work that you commit yourself to, but then it also then comes with community if enough people join, you know? So that's what kind of keeps me from like despairing or feeling like I can't do anything. I don't belong anywhere and my time has passed, right? Which I think we can feel sometimes.
Yeah. Thank you, both of you. Any other questions that are coming or comments or thoughts? Yes, Lee, you're muted.
It seems in my lifetime, in terms of progress, we have seen more progress in women's rights and in gay rights and in Black rights than anywhere else. And I, you know, please refute this if you don't think I'm correct, but I think in a world where we have to look hard to find things to celebrate, the increase in rights for these groups of people is something we can celebrate.
Yeah, go ahead, Mona.
Barbara, and then Ivel.
Well, to sort of piggyback on that idea, it seems to me that change has come, if you look at, you know, from 18th century, 19th century to now, a lot of change has come very, very fast. And Tim, my sense is that one of the things we're seeing is sort of a backlash, because not everybody gets up in the morning and says, oh, I want to change my world today. But I have a question, and it's really to Tim, because he's the historian. In terms of, have people looked at how change happens and in modern times, the time element and how that impacts where we're at in terms of change and implementing more change versus the pendulum swinging the other way?
So thank you both, Lee and Barb. Lee, I love when people like you show up and are in the group, because we need people to remind us, right? I think sometimes those of us who are really committed to social change and social justice are constantly despairing or on the precipice of despair. And I think that's a kind of condition, as well as loneliness. It's like a condition of existence. And I know many of you, if not all of you, feel that way. And I do think we need to remind ourselves, like, wow, like things are different now. I just put in the link, or in the chat, a link to, morning prayers that I gave in October at Harvard, where I took this exact issue on, because I'm finding too often people like nothing's changed, right? Nothing's, I hear this all the time, and I hear it all the time from young people, my students. I hear it all the time from like minoritized people. Right. And I hear, you know, and yet at the same time, you have like people who are more conservative saying like everything's changed and the whole country has gone to hell in a handbasket, which animates the Make America Great Again movement. Right. Like that everything's changed. And so, and both groups are wrong. Everything hasn't changed, but a lot has changed, right? And so I actually take that on. I talk about three ways in which we have to reframe that kind of despairing narrative of nothing has changed. So for what it's worth, it's like a 7-minute talk if you're interested. But one of the things that I talk to my students about all the time, and Barb, this gets to your particular question, is I have this framing of what I call the paradox of progress. And some historians have talked about the cycles of American history, right? The pendulum swings from one to the other. Some of you have very progressive times and then very conservative times. People have often used that to describe the 20th century, right? So you have this period of excess and so forth. And then you have the New Deal, right? You have lavish roaring 20s and then poverty. And then you have the New Deal, which is a super liberal progressive thing. And then you have the Cold War, which is the culture of containment, consensus, and so forth. And then you get the 60s and the 70s and you get all the revolutions. And then you get Reagan and then you get Clinton and then you get Bush again and then you get Obama, you know, and there are ways to like understand that. And a lot of people use metaphors of pendulums and cycles. And I think that those are useful. I mean, all frameworks are both useful and limited, particularly among academics. But I talk about a paradox of progress, which for me feels a little bit more expansive, which means what I mean by that is that like there is progress being made because in any given era of American history or any history, world history, there are social movements and people protesting and making demands and trying to push the envelope and change society. Like that's always the case. There's whether they're underground or above ground or public or private, there's always people who are trying to change society or resist what's happening to move their society a different way or prevent it from going any further. And yet at the same time, and you see this particularly in these really spectacular moments of change, right? The abolition of slavery and Reconstruction, right? The 1960s and 70s with all of these revolutions, feminism and gay and lesbian liberation and Black civil rights and the American Indian movement and the student for democratic society, the peace and anti-war movement, right? All of this fervor, right? And then you get Ronald Reagan and the Christian Coalition and like all this stuff, right? And so oftentimes the fiercest opposition to the progress comes right in the middle of how the progress is being made, or right on the heels of it. And so I always tell my students, if you're interested in like social change, you always have to be like ready to kind of do the work and then celebrate the victories, but then also gird yourself for the backlash. And so when I talk about the paradox of progress, what I mean by that is that we can't just invest ourselves in a kind of narrative of progress that's inevitable or irreversible. Right, that like things are just getting better and better over time, more free, more equal, more rights, because that's not exactly true. While there may be part of that happening to lead to your point, no question that women and gay people and Black people are better off right now than they were 50 years ago on a whole bunch of metrics, right? And yet we have the Dobbs decision that's overruled. We have like the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. We have all of these, you know, 377 anti-LGBTQ bills in state legislatures right now that don't say gay law and others, anti-banning drag in Tennessee, right? So yes, and I tell my students that all the time. I'm like, are gay people, Black people, you know, Latino people, women, right? Are they better off now than they were? On some measures, yeah. And then in other measures, they're not. And the backlash is always sort of part and parcel of the progress too. And so I see this as like the conflict that is the engine of history between forces of progress and justice and forces of reaction and retribution. And we're always kind of caught up in that. And that to me feels always paradoxical, but also full of possibility. So that's kind of how I wrap my head around it. And so that allows me to lead, to your point, to honor and celebrate the change and the progress, but also, Barb, to understand they're coming for all of us. And they're still coming for all of us. And sometimes they're coming for all of us in different ways than they have before. And some of them are using the same old stuff, right? All of the anti-trans, anti-LGBT stuff right now is the same narrative. Ron DeSantis has taken a book out of Anita Bryant's playbook. Right. They're saying the same thing. Ron DeSantis is saying literally the same thing that Anita Bryant was saying in 1977, that Harvey Milk was fighting over in California at the same time.
Well, Tim, I will only say we have a gay son who's now in his mid-50s, and his life today is so much better, so much more open. than I ever thought it possibly could be. And it delights me to see that. And we had a Black president, for Pete's sakes. I agree with you. History progresses and it loops back. But I don't think it loops back as far as it was. I think we get to keep some of the progress. But then we have to, as you're saying, and thank you for doing it, we have to then work when that loops back to build back up again where we want to go.
I love that idea, Lee, a lot about like we, it doesn't all go back. It doesn't all get taken back. And I think that's really important and good for your gay son and I are of the same, I like to say of the same vintage. There's no, like when we grew up, I'm sure he, you know, feels this way too. Like I thought I was going to die of AIDS and that I deserved to die of AIDS. Like that was my entire childhood. I didn't come out until I was 27 because I had internalized all of that. Right now I live in Provincetown with my husband and we walk our dog on the beach every morning. Right. And like, we're pretty free. Right. We hold hands. I'm in an interracial gay marriage and we hold hands in Provincetown in ways that don't bring us fear like it does in other places. And so, yes, you're right. Like we keep some things and yet those things can still be under assault. Right. Even our marriage might be, you know, under assault right now. And we'll fight that, of course, among other things. But the other thing too, and I want to go back to history. You can never take away the history. Once a Black president's been elected and serves two terms, that's on record. Like we know we've done that, right? And so 50 years from now, if we don't have another Black president, shame on us. But we're going to be able to go right back to that record, right? And all these, so that's why these social movements are so important, right? Because they're all on record and so is the backlash. So if we attend to history, right, then we can learn from our mistakes and not make them again. So that's the beauty of history is it's there. It's always there.
And Mona.
Yes. Hi. So yeah, Lee and Tim, I like your points a lot, you know, that, you know, we circle back and, you know, we take a few steps back where we don't lose everything. And Tim, I agree with you. We have to prepare for the backlash and we definitely have made progress, but, from the perspective, like, because I do identify also as a person of color, especially because my dad's family is Arab American and my dad was an immigrant and a refugee from Palestine and moved to Lebanon and so forth. And, you know, where I work, my boss is a Black woman who does research on racial health inequities. And, you know, we pay a lot of attention also to, you know, the issues in criminal justice when, and it's really, I don't know. I don't feel a lot of, optimism right now. You know, the situation, in Israel right now with the most right-wing racist government ever in place and some of the rhetoric that's coming out of there is so worrying. Although I will say that there are so many Jewish American organizations that are stepping up and really calling this out, you know, in a stronger way than ever. That is very hopeful to me. It is, but we also, you know, here in the United States, we also have, you know, Black people still being assaulted, you know, and other people of color and white people too by the police. You know, we all know what happened in Cambridge a few weeks ago, the UMass student to Faisal. And, you know, we have so much work to do still. And I think there's the people who are coming for us are also really good at dividing us and, you know, keeping us running by making us fight battles we've already fought, you know, for example, you know, reproductive rights, but fighting battles again that we've already fought and won. I think we have a lot of work to do. I don't think we can ever at this particularly in this juncture in time ever rest on our laurels. And I think we need to be always scanning the horizon and paying attention and building across, you know, building broad coalitions and working together as much as possible, because I think the problems are very, very deep. And we're fighting a very organized, kind of coordinated, I don't know, anonymous, well, maybe not anonymous, but an enemy of the right-wing forces in this country and in this world. that would really take us back and take back a lot of our, you know, are preventing us from winning all our rights and taking back rights that we've already won. So, yeah, sorry to be not too optimistic.
No, Muna, I appreciate that. I totally agree with you. What's going on in Israel and Palestine right now is unconscionable. And I'm so moved actually by the elevation of consciousness and speaking out among Jewish American citizens also and other kinds of folks. And to call that out, I'm also so disturbed by that. And one of the things, but to your other point, which I always tell my students, this is like one of my like McCarthyism, different kind of McCarthyism. I always say to my students, I said, if we are spending more time fighting each other, then we're perpetrating our own oppression. We're participating in it.
Mm-hmm.
We have to spend more of our energy fighting the forces of injustice and oppression than each other. And too often we fall into that trap and it just plays right in again to their handbook.
Mm-hmm. If the news this morning is to be believed, the streets of Israel are full of protesters against Netanyahu and his trying to go up against the Jewish Supreme Court. So again, I would speak of that as hopeful.
We have a couple more minutes for anyone who hasn't shared yet. Ivo, you were going to go after Barbara.
Let's see.
You're not coming through clearly, Ivo. You're freezing.
Well, I would hope that we can't touch the U.S. Am I freezing? I'm unstable. I'll go.
Try it. Just maybe go out and come in again, or I'm not sure. Try again, Ivo.
Hello?
Yeah, try again. You sound good now.
Hello?
You're good.
Oh, gosh. it makes me sad because I've been on a Zoom surprise birthday call with a phone call from a friend's daughter. And the Zoom was taking place in Harlem. And when I popped up, I was the only Zoom white face there. And my friend Nancy, who was my mother's student in Harlem and the Board of Education, Tim, I'd like to touch base with you about different people on the board. Mom taught in Harlem for 35 years. Nancy was a Price student. Mm-hmm. And so when I was on, I knew people were looking at me and she said, this is my sister from another mother. And, mm-hmm. Sometimes you just have to break through the ice and say it. And women can identify in so many ways as other women, right? Mm-hmm. We have a lot of commonalities. Now, I heard the question, and I'm in Connecticut now. What have I done to try to inform myself to do something about the current situation? Well, right before the pandemic, I signed up for a nonviolent workshop. It's a series of 8 workshops by Virginia Criscow. And in the summer, it's based in Rhode Island. This was all virtual. And that was very informative. It went right through the whole civil rights movement and being nonviolent, continuing to be that way. I created a mezuzah that was secular. And so everyone could make one, hang it on their door. And I thought, well, what word should it say? And this was before the pandemic, before the election. Vote, that's one major way that we can have hope and confidence. Would say vote, and instead of a Torah scroll inside, would have the 6 principles of nonviolence. And in my yard, I have the actual blue stone that Martin Luther King Jr. walked on to get his BU doctorate. And I made a little path, because they were going to throw out all the stone. And I said, no, things can symbolize things and we can memorialize them. So I've learned a lot from Women Explore and I love listening to you, Tim. And it just makes me sad because when we have friends, I help deliver my friend's daughter, and she's Muslim from Morocco. You know, we just have friends everywhere. And so these issues, we have to take into consideration the friendships we've forged. And when I was at BU, my sophomore year, I could care less what dorm I was in. My mother wouldn't let me get an apartment with my girlfriend. And I ended up in a Bay State dorm, brownstone, I didn't know about. We were six white women integrating the black sorority. So,
thank you, Ivel.
Take it from there. Anyway, there's lots of different issues, and teaching the Virgin Islands in various schools was helpful to me too. So you have to get out there and do it, or at least hang a mezuzah on your door.
Do you have any of those mezuzahs left? I would love one of those if you have one. And I'll buy it.
Absolutely, Tim. No, free.
I would love to have one of those. So we'll be in touch for sure.
Yeah, I keep thinking of the phrase, they came to bury us and they forgot we were seeds. That's part of what I don't think I'm quoting it exactly right, but we are going to continue this conversation next week at 10 o'clock. We have from 10 to 11. We